This is Give It A Talk here. Talk to me a little bit.
Yeah, well, if you want to find out what happened at the beginning, that was in 1922, a year after I was born, the station started.
Okay. That's good. That's a good test. Get this over here. All right. Well, this is Jack Fox. We're talking to Louisville broadcast legend Milton Metz. We're at his lovely apartment, and we're just going to visit a little bit about the history of WHAS and his involvement in it. Let's ask first a little bit, Milton, about you. You're not from Louisville.
No, I'm from Cleveland.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, and I grew up there, had a nice youth, and went to the Ohio State University, and then I was in the Army.
From Ohio State University. What did you study at Ohio State?
I was education, teaching. I had a radio job while my...
Oh, you did? Oh. Yeah. Were you planning a career in radio, or were you planning a career in teaching?
No, I was just fell in love like so many people, including yourself, fell in love with radio early. But teaching was, in those days, quote, you had something to fall back on. But I had no intention of doing that. I wanted to be a radio announcer.
Really? You sound like I heard an interview with George Clooney and his dad, Nick. And Nick wanted to be an actor, and his dad kept saying, well, finish college and have something to fall back on. He said, Dad, I'm not going to fall back.
Yeah.
So that was your approach.
Be compared with the Clooneys, they're a great family and nice people.
What inspired that? What made you want to be in radio?
Well, I was an actor in high school.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And I was in public speaking in my high school, Glenville, in Cleveland, was very active in the dramatic arts. We would put on plays like classics, like Our Town by Frank Wilder, classical, good plays. And one of our guys won a radio playwriting contest for the American Automobile Association, whose subject was safety on the road. And we were all taken to Washington and recorded a series of safety programs. I went up there as a sound effects man. That was my first job.
Is that right?
And they gave
technical
me a
job.
Yeah, I would, you know, call home and say, you hear that automobile screech? That's me operating it. And they gave me some parts, and I fell in love with that. And then I got a job at the Ohio State University, acting in plays, and I got a job downtown with a commercial radio station.
Really?
And it continued. Of course, in the Army, they didn't want to hear about that.
So you went from Ohio State into the Army then?
Yes.
Were you drafted, or was this a time that you just joined and you...
No, I was drafted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you see duty overseas?
No, I was in the Army for 3 years, but I didn't... I wasn't shipped overseas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Closest I got was guarding some German prisoners of war. It was not dangerous, but, you know, it was 3 years out of my life. And when I came back, I needed a job. I answered an ad in Broadcasting Magazine. It's a professional.
Sure, I remember.
It was a box number, so I didn't know to whom I was applying. And they, to my surprise, I sent them a big radio transcription in those days, about 12 inches of record, record.
So you were prepared for it. You had to give them some kind of
example
of what you did.
Well, I read a newspaper column, a sports column, and they thought I was a great sportscaster, but it was just...
What was available.
This paper. But the funny thing about it was, they hired me sight unseen. That was their first mistake, Jack. But they gave me the job without seeing me. It was very strange, because they never did it again when I knew it, or before.
Wow. Now, did you, you had no contact with Louisville before? You knew nothing
about
Louisville.
I didn't know where Louisville was.
Is that right?
Huh. Because I answered the box.
Sure. So you accept this job. How long did it take in conversation from the time that they called you? I mean, did you negotiate? Did you say, the job is mine, I'm there next Monday? Or how?
Yeah, it was too soon. It was tough on my mom, because I left shortly after I got out of the Army.
I regret
that to this day, that I didn't say, you know, give me a month off and I'll be back. But I was so grateful to get a job.
Sure.
That I accepted and went right down there.
What was the status of radio announcers at that? Were your parents proud of the fact that you were in radio. They said, no, go get a teaching job. How did they feel about that?
No, my father at that time was dead. Both my parents were immigrants. My mother from England, my father from Russia. And they just wanted me, you know, they didn't know much about that kind of stuff. And they just wanted to be a success. I was, you know, I was a teenager, off to school. And I got a job in school, and they wished, my mother wished me well. My two sisters were great supporters of me. So when I came here, I was a rookie, and they treated me very well. But we worked, it was a rickety old radio station.
Well, you went through several studios, David. Where was this one?
This was downtown Louisville. It was adjacent to the building on Liberty and 3rd, where the newspaper was being published. We were adjacent to it. It was a done over warehouse. Huh. And it was on the second floor. You went up. It was like a tenement. And
this was, what year was this? This was
46.
46, okay. So the station was only 20 plus years old at that time.
That's right, it was 24 years old.
Yeah.
And it was really radio before TV had made a contact. To give you an idea, it was so primitive that the walls for acoustics used those waffle undercoats for rugs, you know?
Yes.
And they were draped on the walls to soften the sound. And it was really primitive. I mean, and it was early radio. Would you believe we had a religion editor full time?
No.
We had a music director full time. And I did learn until later that money wasn't a key issue. For them, not for me.
That was the Bingham, right?
Yeah, they were.
This was the Bingham family.
Yeah, the Bingham family were benevolent owners, and they.
Yeah, they owned the Courier Journal.
They owned the Courier, and they made money from the Courier and the, at that time, Standard Gravure, a printing adjunct.
All the Sunday inserts and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and the Police Gazette, they
printed really?
Things like that. It was very prominent. But they weren't seeking to make a lot of money. Or make money at all at the radio station.
I thought I read something that, their purpose to put it on was to enrich the community with arts and information and things.
I read an early application, Jack, that says exactly that. The management at that time in the 20s when they started said, we don't want to do any commercial stuff.
Yes, that right.
That's right, not in that language, but yes. They weren't going to do any commercial advertising. So that wasn't, and much of that philosophy carried over.
It was still there by the time when you came, huh?
Yeah, at that time.
Now, I remember reading or hearing a lot. In fact, when I was there at this station, I think his picture was still on the wall, a fellow named Credo Harris.
Right.
What kind of influence did he have at that time? Was he the person who hired you? Or?
No, but he was the manager. He was on his way out. He was a bit ready to retire. I think he was a courier, a newspaper friend of the Binghams.
Ah.
And he was not a real broadcaster, but was an executive. I don't think he was there much when I was there.
I see.
Shortly after that, when Vic Sholas was appointed.
Oh, yes, I remember that name, huh? So it had begun to evolve a little bit by the time you'd gotten there. Although, I remember reading in one archive, I think Dorothy Kirchable, was that her name? She was a secretary to one of the Binghams, or Mr. Harrison, said they referred to it as the radio station as a three-ring circus. Does that ring a bell?
No, that doesn't, but...
That must have been the early days, a little bit.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but I remember that there was still talk about guys like Foster Brooks, who had been active in the flood of 1937.
So Foster was there when you were there?
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't.
But his brother was, Tom.
Oh, yes, Cactus.
He had been hired a little before I did.
Who were they? Who were the people there when you were there? Were any names that we would recall?
Well, Jim Walton was there.
Oh, yes.
George Walsh, who was sports director, later became program director, was prominent. Pete Disney was there as a chief producer. His name was Ricardo. That was when people were sensitive about ethnic names. I don't know, Ricardo's a perfectly good name. It was good enough for Desi Lou.
Yeah.
Anyway, interesting thing happened. While I was there, there was a program director named Dick Fisher. very natty guy, big guy, authoritative. We had, I think, when would the 25th anniversary have been? From 22 would have been 47.
47, yeah, right after you came.
It was a big deal, and I think it was a broadcaster in Columbia Auditorium. At any rate, we had a new manager, Vic Sholas, who had come down from his position as an executive of Clear Channel Broadcasting, which was not today's Clear Channel Broadcasting, but it was the association of 50,000 watt stations, and he was the executive. And Mark Etheridge, who was the publisher of the Courier, met him there and was impressed by him and invited him to succeed Credo Harris. So Sholas came in almost at the same time I was, and he was ticked off because the program director, Dick Fisher, didn't show up for the anniversary broadcast. And the producer of it, this Pete Riccardi, Pete Disney, produced it. He was there, and he succeeded in the job because Sholas didn't like it that this guy didn't show up.
How about that?
Huh? He had a, it was a bowling night for
him. Some things are important. Yeah. Yes. Well, now, what was your role? You were an announcer? What did they have?
I was an announcer. We were with CBS then, and they would say, and we carried a lot of broadcasts, a lot of soap operas.
Yeah, I wonder what your programming was like.
Yeah, it was
network or local.
A lot of network stuff, soap operas, and they would say, today they say the CBS, they would say, this is the Columbia Broadcasting System, and you would say WHS Louisville, and then you'd wait.
You just had a little booth to do that?
Yeah, a little tiny booth. And there were tricks people played, because they'd wait till the last minute. And one time the microphone was on a suspension pulley, and some wise guys tied it up with tape, and you had climb and put obstacles in the booth. And that was when there was a lot of chicanery there.
Did you when you came, you were a new kid on the block?
Yeah. This guy.
Did old timers have advice for you or anything?
No, but they were very nice to me. Yeah, very good. There was Jim Walton and a guy named Bodorf, and Jack Wilson was there, and some guy named Ward. And it was convivial.
Now, did they also do live band broadcast orchestras and things like that? Did they have some house orchestras?
They eventually did. They were doing,
but not at that time.
The big live one was Rentro Valley Gathering, mm-hmm, that they did remote. That was carried, I don't know if it was carried nationally or not, but we were very well known. John Lair. And they had a lot of country singers later became stars. And we did later, we had a house orchestra, 14 pieces. And at one time, we had an afternoon program, eventually called a matinee with Mets. I was the host for it. We had a girl singer and a boy singer and a 12 or 14 piece orchestra.
Who were the singers? You remember who the singers were?
No, I don't, but they were nice people. And it's inconceivable these days that a station could afford to have that.
They were on staff there.
Yeah.
Wow. Huh. What hours did the station broadcast? Were they around the clock or from early in the morning till in the evening? Do you recall? Or
yeah, they had an all night program. Kentucky Calls America.
Really?
Yeah, and it was heard widely because there were fewer stations then.
Sure.
And they were broadcast all over.
Now, this was quite prestigious, a 50,000-watt radio station,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, Milton, when you went there, when was your last broadcast at WHAS? What year was your last broadcast?
Probably 2003.
Did you have any idea you would be there? Were you planning, so, well, this is home, I'll be here the rest of my life? Or
no.
You think, I'll go here and I'll get to New York or L.A. or something?
No, I didn't. I made a couple of ventures out of the city, but I had no long-range plans. I liked what I was doing. I met a wonderful girl here. I had a great life here.
So you met Miriam here, then you met Miriam here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure.
My wife was a native. She was on the cover of Roto magazine, and Mrs. Metz didn't raise any dummies, and I had a chance for a blind date with her, and it all, we lived happily ever after.
That's great. One son?
One son.
Yeah, great. Very good, very good. So you didn't think you'd be there? What were the studios like? You mentioned you have a, you had a little booth. You, was that pretty much the radio station?
Yeah, it was like an enlarged phone booth, but it was big enough because there wasn't a lot of live stuff then. They did.
Did local newscasts?
They did local newscasts were big. Well, the big newscast was at 10 p.m. A man named Pete French was the number one newscaster in this area, and he was on, and he would always, he's an interesting guy. He had a certain style that may not have gone today, but it was very popular then, and he'd stop in the middle of a commercial and say, "I'll be back, but here's Milton Metz again." So I said, "My name is not Metz again." So the next time he said, "Here's Milton Metz again." But they were looser, you know.
Sure. Now, you mentioned the program Kentucky Calls America. That was on overnight, did you say?
Yes.
It was. What? That wasn't a call-in type program.
No,
that
it was
music.
Kentucky
music.
Yeah.
Just to, it was recorded music or?
It was all that. I was on the all-night one for about 3 days, and I didn't hack it. I didn't like it.
It
wasn't well.
What were your hours when you first went there?
Oh, no, whatever they gave me.
Yeah.
Probably weekend.
So you did a shift then?
It was regular. And the guys were very helpful. It was very nice. They all came to my wedding. The joke was that it was a warm day. I think I got married. I can't remember. A warm day in May, and the windows were open, and as the rabbi said, "Do you take this woman, you know that?" Arthur Godfrey's radio program was broadcasting through an open window, and he was on CBS, and the guys swear that instead of saying, "I do," I said, "WHAS Louisville," because the broadcast said this is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
And that was your cue, right?
That was my cue. And I said, "I never said I do."
Well, whatever, it worked out.
Well, they were collegial. It was a lot of fun.
That's good. Yeah, the station seems to have a history of that. I know when I came, it was very much that way with you and Perky and Malloy and all the people. It was great. It was a great time. Well, we'll get back to some more radio stuff, but I want to ask, you were there when television came along.
Yeah.
That was in the early 50s at some point?
Yeah. So.
Now, how did the guys who are already established on radio, were they excited about television?
No, they took it as a matter of course. I wanted to be on it. And I thought, I wondered how I would do it. And I conceived of a weather show with the help of my wife. And things were primitive. You know, you pointed to the map, and this is Ohio, and that's California, and it's going to rain here, and it's going to be sunshine there. So I thought of getting a magnetic board, and I learned that Cool Cigarettes was looking for a televised program. That's when you could advertise cigarettes. So I devised a number of symbols with the Cool Cigarette Penguin, you remember? And
sure,
that was the
Willow
logo.
The Penguin, yeah.
And I would show a penguin with vertical stripes or diagonal stripes would indicate rain, and then a penguin with the sun over him, and different ones. So then I knew they were coming down, and I prepared an audition. They let me do it, so that you, as you said, rain is forecast, you would put up the magnetized figure of the penguin holding an umbrella, and it would stick to the map.
Sure, yeah.
Not the dumbest idea. And they came, and it was 8 o'clock in the morning, a funny audition. And since I was the only one prepared, I got the job.
How about that?
And then my wife had devised something known as the Magic Weather Writer. Magic Weather Writer was a box with mirrors in it. And so when an unseen hand would write on it, the camera would zoom in on it, and it would seem like it was invisible writing, say, partly cloudy and sunny.
Wow.
And instead of it being backwards, which it would be, they had the mirror.
Yeah, the mirror there.
Two mirrors there, and until, you know, a guy spelled cloudy and misspelled it, and left out a letter here or there. But it was...
Partly cloudy, huh?
Cloudy, yeah, that's right. But it was effective for that time.
And your wife devised that?
Yeah, she and they built it. I'm always sorry I never kept it. I think they tore it up for kindling wood or something.
Yeah, so So you were one of the guys that saw a future in that. You thought this
Well, I wanted to be a part of it, and what the great opportunity was that you do radio and TV at the same time.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I did a number of things. I had, you know, asked the mayor, that kind of thing. And
you were one of the first. You were one of the first weather guys, then, I guess, on television.
Yeah, Ray Sheldon. I think Ray Sheldon may have had a step in there first too, but.
But you were noted for. Weren't you the one that would pick out the Caribou Maine or something? Or
that's right. That was my slogan at the end. I would say, and in Caribou, the temperature is 25, and people would say, "Oh, why the hell? You know, why are you mentioning Caribou?" Well, of course, it didn't matter. It was in Caribou, but it was a funny name, and it was always colder than the devil.
Sure.
And so I used it as sort of a trademark, harmless. Wait, but
how many years did you do weather on television? You did for a long time.
Well, I forgot.
Yeah, long time.
Now I think maybe 19 years.
Yeah, you were well known for that.
Yeah, I had a theme song, Weather. Everybody talks about, nobody does a thing about the weather.
Did you sing it? Or
Here Comes the Weather Vane. No, I didn't sing it. It's a recorded jingle there. It's somewhere in the archive.
Very good. Very good. Well, now you also did
a video. Oh, once, I'll tell you what I did once. I said, you know, they don't always get close-ups. I said, and you don't know what I look like because they're distant shots. So I have arranged to have a close-up, but I put a picture of Robert Redford. That's what I look like.
Well, you know, they said television ruined a lot of good radio announcers because he looks like that. That's what he looks like. But you thrived on it. That was good.
A lady wrote me once on the radio. She said, oh, I know what you look like. You're a plump little fellow with blonde curls. I said, oh, yeah, sure. That was before I got on TV.
Now, you did, of course, Weather, but you did the program Ask the Mayor, but you launched the program Omelet, too, didn't you?
Yes.
The first talk shows like that.
Yes, with my partner Faith Lyles and Dave Jones, who was the producer, and we did that for 9 years in the 70s. It was
great. Memorable moments there. Do you remember some of the people you had on there? Famous guests. Anybody came through town, you had them.
Yeah, we had Vice President Bush at that time, Senior Bush, Manilow, country singers, anybody came by.
I would be on the radio at noon, and your program was, let's see, what time is your program? The Omelet was on at what time?
Well, it had varied.
I remember one time I would be on at noon, and I would get your guests after they came to you. I got the leftovers.
That was good.
But we had Muhammad Ali one day. It was great. I had a throng out there, people just packed, pulled up in front with a police escort. The mayor was with him, and everybody was
there. Ali was on my radio program 5 times and a couple of times on TV. I liked him very much. He was just a charming, handsome guy, and you know, and he got in the ring too much and wound up with Parkinson's.
Yeah. We'll talk some more in a minute about your radio program. I want to just a few more things about television. You mentioned that at that time there was a great collegiality between WHAS radio and TV. Can you talk about that some more? People went back and forth. Many people went back and forth with both.
Yeah, because
jobs.
We were on the same building.
And over the same
company. Floor, yeah. And if you had a good idea, I had an idea once for a safety program. And there were more liberal in accepting your idea. You could be an entrepreneur. Not that you would get paid extra, but if you had a creative idea, I had an idea for doing the safety program for the auto club, and I got some filming and did that kind of stuff. They wanted to do a program with the mayor, and they built a whole set about it. That was when Harvey Sloan was the mayor, and I was the MC, and that was called Ask the Mayor, probably. And the only trouble was the mayor was there to launch great ideas about the future of the city, and most people asked him how they get rid of a dog messing up their yard.
And you had to control that. Yes. Well, you were always great at that. That was great. So that collegiality continued for many years there. Same building, crossed over.
And it was a good opportunity if you had a good TV idea, you know, and you could do it. And same thing with radio. And you want to talk about TV now first?
Sure, let's talk more about TV, sure.
It was interesting, and that was filming. They had to develop the film for news.
That oh, yes, huh? Yeah. You saw a lot of changes in that area there, didn't you?
That's right. That was before TV was very big. And in the beginning then, you had opportunities to try new things. And doing commercials was a very big part of it because it was live. And that
oh,
was
yes.
before teleprompters, and that was
that
really
had to some interesting moments. You remember some things like
oh, really?
And embarrassing moments that you had to put
oh,
on?
Oh, yeah. I once, the worst thing that ever happened to me, and you know, it's mishaps because of live television.
Sure.
I always say that's how you judge a guy, how he does with, there's no script, how good they are, a woman or a man. If they can handle themselves all right, that's pretty good. So I'm doing a commercial for a Pepsi-Cola, and I said Coca-Cola, and it was a Friday night, and I was no way I could get out of it, and I was just embarrassed, and I couldn't wait till Monday. I called one of my bosses Friday night, and thanks to him, he said, it's all right, I'll see you Monday. You know, it made me feel all right, but it was terrible.
Sure.
Or once I had this was live, and live would kill you.
No going back, no editing the tape, none of that.
The worst thing was pouring a beer on commercials because they wanted the head on, and that's when you could do beer commercials.
Yeah.
And they not only wanted a foam on top, they wanted it curved on top. So you had to make a perfect pour. And some poor guy, he's reading the... not teleprompter, he's reading a paper that's pinned,
sure,
glued to the camera, and he's looking, reading it, and he's pouring it, and the son looks it on, he's pouring it on the desk, he's missed the glass and
he's looking, reading his script.
Oh, no, it's just terrible. And there was one guy, Lee Jordan, who later went to CBS, he would put his, it was like typewriter paper, only pasted all together. He had a long cue sheet that he pasted to the camera, but it was so long that it went down to the floor. And as he read it, instead of him pulling it up so it would be an eye level with the lens, he was looking down at the floor by the end of the commercial. And those things happened.
Teleprompters helped a lot of people.
I had to do one on triple tilt. The storm windows, Easy Jack, a child could do it. And as I said, a child could do it. It got stuck halfway in and halfway out. And there was no way out of it. And the blood drained from my face. And those were the horror moments of live television.
Yeah, nothing like that anymore, is there?
No.
Did you have experience with the teleprompter after that? How'd that go? Did that go smooth?
Oh, the teleprompter came later, yeah. You'd find it, you would pin it on, you would write it on your wrist or
everything, huh? Learned all the tricks how to.
But it was chancy though. It was difficult without cue sheets, and the cue sheets were there.
When you were doing the weather, do you recall who some of the anchor people were on television?
A guy named Engel, I think. I'm not sure. I don't
remember too much. Who would have been through there during that time.
Mort Krim was back there.
Ah,
he was good. He's a
good
newscaster. And I enjoyed it. It didn't have the prominence then it does now. Nowadays, you have a storm coming and everything stops and you're meteorologist.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't say meteorologist. They say meteorologist, Jack.
Yeah.
A meteorologist would take over for 3 hours. It's like they were waiting in the wings for bad weather to come.
Praying for it, lighting.
There's a cloud out there, and I'm going to spend 3 hours telling you where it is and where it came from. I mean, let's face it, weather's all right, but it's not warfare. It's not.
One of the things, the difference between radio and television, was, of course, television, you're on cam, you have to be aware of your appearance. Radio was a little more laid back, although I think in the early days and when you started, and up for a long time, even announcers then were pretty professionally dressed, weren't they?
Exactly. And wore a jacket all the time at the time.
Even on the radio, yeah.
Yes, it was. Yes. And we looked pretty good. I don't remember when that changed, but all of a sudden I realized a colleague of mine, who should remain nameless, came in February, he's wearing shorts, He's got hairy knuckles and he's wearing sandals. He's got hairy toes. Very unappetizing. And now suddenly, you know, they're wearing.
Yeah.
A sweater was a big deal. No, they were, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was nice to be dressed up.
It was a profession. It was very much a profession, an honored profession. Anything else about television you think about comes to mind?
No, but we didn't realize we were sort of pioneers. I mean, they were doing big
things. Certainly were, though, yeah.
On the network, they were doing wonderful, dramatic things. They didn't get too far afield. Then Crusade for Children came and more sophisticated things come.
You were involved in the early ones of those, weren't you?
Yeah, I only missed one in the last 57 years. But I loved the assignments on Derby Day. That was good.
Well, let's talk some about Derby Day. You did that for radio and television, but you were at Millionaire's Row.
The first time I did the Derby was the infield. And that was like going to World War II. I mean, that was, nowadays it's pretty raunchy, but then it was bacchanalian. It was the
debauched.
I mean, behind every bush, you didn't know what kind of act was going on. But I can't mention this is a family.
Well, this is radio or television?
This is radio, the first one.
Yeah.
And I survived it. And the TV guys saw that I got out with my life because, you know, you get sophomores who are geared up and they want to jump on the mic and half-dressed women who are waving their bras around. That was kind of wild there. And I couldn't enjoy the sights
because you were working.
But I devised a good system. I tried to find somebody who had an accent or something. Not just some mouthy kid who wanted to say hi, mom, on it. I wanted to get somebody interested to come from, you know, Panama or Spain or England, and I would listen, and it would make for a good broadcast. So it was difficult, but very trying. It was a good test. The next year, they put me on TV, and that was even tougher because in the infield, that was really, really something to get somebody, because there was always clowns who wanted to get in, so you had to fight your way through it. But if you worked hard, you would get some interest. Now they had people with a beard or facial hair, and even the men.
You were waiting for that.
Yeah, he set you up.
Good brother. Still got it. That's great.
But then I got promoted to and working with guys like wonderful guys like Haywood Ledford, the best man I ever worked with, worked with some good talent.
Wow.
And he was one of America's. I'll tell you why he was so good. He did basketball, football, and then the third one, thoroughbred horse racing. I don't know another newscaster, a sportscaster in America who was an ace, and he was an ace.
And when he
shared the microphone with you, not everybody I did, some people were piggish that I worked with, who shall remain nameless, who didn't like to share the microphone. He was a gentleman. He never, even though he had more knowledge than most of us, he never spoke down to you and gave you your time on mic. It was a very collaborative thing. It was a very privilege working with Caywood, whom I dearly loved. And then I was promoted to doing my favorite, all-time favorite and difficult one, was interviewing celebrities at Derby Day.
Tell us about the difficulty. Most people think that would be a plum assignment. And it was, but what was the difficulty?
The difficulty was that they were there to play, they weren't there to do. And some of them had, quote, their secretaries with them. Who happened to be 22 years old and very beautiful. You know, they want to make a big deal out of it. And they wanted fun, they wanted to eat the shrimp, and they want to have a drink, and they weren't ready to talk to you. So you had to be careful how you did it.
So you could tell when you got ready to approach somebody.
Well, it helped me if I knew the host. That helped me. They would introduce me. And it was doubly difficult because at that time I did radio and TV at the same time. I was holding two microphones.
Wow.
They were simulcast.
That's how you did that.
Yes, it was done. And so you had to know that what you were saying made sense to both media. And so you had a sound man here, and then you had a cameraman there and a producer. So you traveled with a team, and it's very crowded up in Millionaire's Row. So you have the logistics of working with crowds, and then you want to go up and speak to a guy like Walter Cronkite or President Bush, if he was there, or Morley Safer from CBS,
sure,
or Mary Hart. And you didn't want to, you had two things to think about. One, you didn't want to go up there as some hillbilly shuffling your feet and say, shucks, ma'am, can I have a word? You don't want to play that country rude kind of thing. On the other hand, you didn't want to be brash and a smart aleck. So, and it was only 2 minutes, about 2 minutes.
Sure, yeah.
Maybe a minute and a half to 3 minutes. So it was very, and what helps was if you knew something about the person. Like I met Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, you remember that?
Sure.
Great singing team on Tonight Show. I happened to run into them in the hallway. So you didn't always plan. Sometimes you knew where they sat, sometimes you didn't. And I said, how about you give me a couple of minutes? And they were a very nice young couple, married, and it was like serendipity. I mean, I found somebody who was really famous because that perked up the broadcast. And I got a good line. I said to Edie Gourmet, I said, you've been married a long time. What's the secret? She said, oh, I didn't know. She said, in all those years, we've never had a serious conversation. So if you get people like that, they make your broadcast.
Yeah.
And then I've got both radio and TV at the same time. So you're maneuvering around. It was very exciting. And then when you go, if you knew something about our friends, I knew that Steve Lawrence was a singer, but also he was very good in comedy skits. He did a good German accent, got a lot of laughs.
So yeah, were they with Sid Caesar or were they?
No, they were. I think with Steve L. Lawrence.
Yeah, that's what Steve L.
He appreciated that. I said, I didn't say you're a good singer. I said, I love your work on your comedy. Oh, well, he lit up because
that was something.
I did my homework. If I knew, the more I knew about somebody, the more likely I was to get a nice response. And not ask, learn. Don't ask questions that can be answered yes or no. You'll be dead.
So that's kind of your philosophy of interviewing.
Yes, I have a strong philosophy of interviewing.
Tell me a little more about that. I mean, you said some things about it, but tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I wrote a code for myself. Mm-hmm. Made a couple of talks about that. Don't ask questions that can be answered yes or no, with rare exceptions. Do your homework. Learn what you can about the party you're going to interview, because you don't always have a paper in front of you. Third, maybe first, is listen. The guy says, yeah, I chopped up my mother with an axe. And then you say, well, how many kids do you have? You don't do that. You know, you listen.
Yeah, yeah.
You listen to what they say. And you hear this all the time, don't parrot them. You say, where are you from? They say, I'm from Sandusky, Ohio. Sandusky, Ohio, how many kids do you have? I have three. Oh, three. See, and yeah, you find
sure,
a lot of
sure,
interviewers
yeah.
doing that. Even Leno does that sometimes, as good as he is. Mm-hmm. So, and
this is a digression, but I always consider Johnny Carson a good interviewer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Carson was good. He didn't mind.
Same type thing.
Well, he let people, his guests, shine.
That's a key to it.
You can't be egotistical and make the show about yourself.
Yeah.
Some people can.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the guests you had on Millionaire. You mentioned Walter Cronkite a while ago. It went beyond meeting him on Millionaire's Row. You guys became friends for a long time.
Yeah, I was never a confidant of him, but he was one of the genuine persons, and maybe the most important, nice person I met. I met a lot of them.
Very influential guy at that time, wasn't he?
Yeah, when I met him, he came here the first time. He was getting, he had two hobbies, sailboat boating and tennis. I learned about that. And he was here to
from
get
your homework, yeah.
Yeah, and he was then the most respected man. I once asked him, I said, is that sure you're the most respected? Oh, he says, well, My wife would raise an eyebrow. But he was just a modest guy.
Sure.
And good, come along with you. So he was going to get an award from the Coast Guard for his waterworks and safety or something. And they sent me out to do an interview out at the Executive Inn near Freedom Hall. So it was a beautiful day. I said, Walter, and he didn't mind my calling him his first name, let's go outside and do it. We perched on a stone fence. I've got a picture of it on my wall here. And we're just sitting there, and he was so gracious. We went for 17 minutes. So it was so pleasant. It was so nice. And the photo, I got an autograph picture of him. He's looking up in the sky, and I'm looking thoughtfully, and he says, I didn't think your question was all that thoughtful, Bill. I mean, he was just inside the water. He was just a wonderful guy. So I said, Walter, I said, I understand you play tennis. He said, yeah, I do. I said, would you like to play? Yeah, he goes. I said, do you want to play this afternoon or tomorrow morning? He said, how about both?
Really?
No. He said, but I don't have any tennis guard, no clothes. So I wanted to play tennis with the most. And I was at his height, the most respected voice in America. So I got a pair of shorts from him, which he's a little plump, and he promptly split with it. But a girl I know gave him a racket. And I got an 84 WHS t-shirt. To this day, I got a picture of Walter Cronkite wearing an 84 WHS t-shirt. And they never put it in a billboard. I mean, what could be
right,
a...
Yeah.
I've got it in my scrapbook, but the station, the dummies, didn't know enough to know they had this great guy.
Wow.
So we go out to play. He's wearing all borrowed stuff. And we're the nearest court, it's a public court, near, I think it was municipal courts on Illinois Avenue, near the zoo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we go there. And we're playing, and it's pretty good. We're playing singles, and it's very pleasant. And the ball goes on to the next court. Well, in etiquette, as you know, it's a thank you. Guy picks up the ball, he raises his hand, throws the ball back to us, and he looks over, and he sees us playing. He sees Walter Cronkite. But he can't believe it, because what are we doing on a public, why aren't we in a private court somewhere in the country club? Is that Cronkite? And what's Cronkite doing with that guy Metz? So, but he wants to play cool, and he throws the ball back, and we play. Anyway, that night, Cronkite, he invites us to the event. My wife and I, Miriam and I, go there, and he invites us over to a corner where he sits down and pulls up a pants leg. And there he has tucked into his socks the bottom of his pajamas. He says, Milt, he says, I sweated up my jockey shorts playing with you, and I have to use my pajamas. Now, where can you hear that? You hear that?
Most respected man in America.
And so the next day, my wife comes at lunchtime, gives him a brown paper bag. He says, what's in there? She says, it's a new athletic supporter. The only person in America who bought an intimate garment for the most famous guy. No, it was a cute story, but I played once with him in New York.
I thought you played some there.
Yeah,
I went
there. Yeah. I played with him up in New York on a funny building. It was on the 10th floor on the roof, and we played with Bill Small, who used to be there, was now with CBS, Cronkite, and the president of the network. Now, this president of the network, when he played tennis, he's a poacher. I don't know if you know what a poacher is. A poacher doesn't stay by his side at the net. He poaches to the middle of the network, but the middle of the net. But because he's the president, they didn't try to sneak
him
past. As soon as they noticed he was being fired, they start shooting
no
the ball down the alley. But they did it.
No mercy.
But it was nice.
Interesting. Let's talk for a minute about Juniper 52385. How did that begin? What was the idea for that? Was that another one of your ideas that you...
No, that's George Walsh, ex sportscaster and program director. I had heard about there were some talk shows like that in the West Coast. There weren't much.
You weren't in here, no.
But it wasn't, and wanted me to do it. and I didn't know anything about it, and I heard a couple of recordings of this guy on the West Coast, and I was in, late 50s, I did it for 33 years.
Was an evening program when it first started? Or
yeah, it was an evening, and George would produce it, and it was, and it was, they didn't like the cult of personality. Instead of calling it the Johnson program, they call it morning AM or afternoon PM. Yeah, yeah. It was ridiculous. As if, and actually, so they wouldn't call it by my name. They called it Juniper 52385, which I promptly forgot. I would give the wrong number.
Hey, for an interesting program.
I mean, I was worried about doing a good program there.
And the callers would call and give you the right number. Say, you know,
well, they finally put a sign up in the window and you dummy, there's your number.
How long had the program been on before you took it over?
I started.
Oh, you started the program, okay.
And I learned that. It was a great learning experience over the years because you're flying free without a script.
No other local call-in programs at that time?
No, there were. They started. We had one in the afternoon, FYI, for information.
Yeah.
This was the one. And because it was such a big voice on the station.
Sure.
With, I have a map to this day with hundreds of pins from...
I remember that map, yeah.
Dozens of states, including Alaska and Panama and so forth. And it was a great learning experience. And one of my tests for even broadcasters today and myself is how good they can do without a script. That's why so many Hollywood actors don't do well on TV in an interview show, because they're good actors, but they can't think on their feet. And a lot of broadcasters, the best ones, I think, can do that, you know, like a guy like Anderson Cooper,
sure,
and Brian Williams, and some of our local people.
How did you initially begin to prepare for that program? It was all new territory. How did you begin to prepare?
I just come up with a topic, and it
you had a topic each night.
Yeah, each night. Yeah.
You do research on that topic.
Yeah, and I'd have a guest sometimes, and it started off well. I mean, I got you worry about. I didn't have trouble in the beginning getting. I would have somebody call, but generally.
I remember. If this is true, tell me if this story is true. I had one of your producers one time tell me that. You had a signal to the producer back who was manning the phones and screening the calls. It was a slow night. You had no communication, so you'd point to the ring finger on your left hand, and that meant what? What did that mean?
I mean, call my wife.
And she would do what?
She would ask a provocative question.
And get things rolling.
Yeah, it was not dishonest, but I didn't fake it, but she would help it, you know.
Sure.
And. In the beginning, I got it started, but then it went very well, and it was commercially successful and provided me a nice career.
Well, now, you know, talk shows have changed a lot. Let's talk for a minute about how did you were very neutral. I mean, you obviously had opinions, but you did express those very rarely. What was your philosophy on
that? My philosophy was this. Talk about anything you want to, including some on the seam sex programs. I mean, difficult programs. But I had a couple of rules I want. If I knew a thing was being said that was a lie, I would challenge it.
From a caller or a guest?
Yeah, mostly a caller. I would call them on it. If I knew it was a falsehood, I was not going to let them use my program as a forum. And the other one, I wouldn't let them libel somebody. I wouldn't say, Senator so-and-so is a crook. Now, he may have been a crook, but I didn't want him libeled on my program without sufficient proof. Those were the things. Nowadays, of course, talk show hosts almost don't need an audience because they have their own ideology. They might as well have a monologue. My idea is a talk show is for the people to give their opinions, good, bad, valid, or invalid. That doesn't seem to be so today. Today, a talk show host has a point of view. And of course, I had thoughts on all of them, but...
Sure. And at the appropriate times, you expressed those, but you didn't. There was an appropriate time, or whatever.
I tried not to, Jack. But I'd let the people call and let them give their opinion. That's changed considerably. It seems to be successful.
Were there any, when you... Were there taboos over the subjects you wouldn't approach, or was open game, or how did you choose your guests? How did you choose your guests?
I didn't have a lot of guests, but nobody ever said don't discuss this. And the biggest one I thought I would have when we talked about sex, had sex programs. You know, it's a delicate one. I had a couple of hilarious calls, and so one time I lost control of myself because sex can be funny too, you know.
But and your expert there was such a sweet sounding lady. She was a wonderful lady.
She had a voice like Shirley Temple, and she could say these these mature things. Oh, Jean, she was just wonderful. But very informative. A lot of people learned a lot of things that I never got. They never complained. The management never said, don't talk about sex. Because I didn't do it with a cheap way. Or stilted. We talk without being vulgar. We talk real stuff, Jack. I learned a lot.
You were taking notes.
Yeah, me too. I was.
Any of those times you pointed and said, call Miriam?
Yeah, you hear that?
That was good. Very good. Did you ever have any pressure from management or anything about topics or what to do or not to do or anything?
No. And have politicals on and
yeah.
guys, you know.
Have favorites? This is talking out of turn, but we're having lunch before we came in. Representative Romano Mazzoli came by, and you guys were obviously affectionate, had good feelings for each other. He must have been one of your favorites.
Oh, yeah, he was good, and Happy Chandler was always good.
Oh, yeah.
Chandler was wonderful, and I got a call from, I saw his picture in the paper, it was Tom T. Hall, the country.
Yes, huh?
He once called up and said, I'm a genetic program. And once, and this killed me, Jack Parr was riding home to Westchester County. And the next night he says, I heard this guy Metz in Kentucky. It was a good program. And they didn't carry it in Louisville. Nobody in Louisville heard it.
Oh, my gosh.
It killed me because he was very popular at that time.
Yeah, he is.
But it had, the station had just great broadcast power.
We had some memorable moments being on the air live like that. I remember the tornado. I remember one night, the night of the tornado, you were... Metz here was the central power was out. You were communicating calls, and I remember there was one call, and all I heard was this voice say, "Hello, Milton. This is Wendell. Yeah. Tell me about that."
Well, that was he the
governor? The governor, yeah. Wendell Ford, the governor, before
he was senator, and he called up.
I thought it was interesting. You two were close enough to be conversational.
You got to know a lot of influential people there, and if you behave like a Metz, you know, they would treat you well, and I got to know a lot of important people. I wasn't their confidant, but they could trust me, and Ford knew that he would get a lot of storm information out during the tornado. And I, Dick Gilbert, who was the hero, who was flying a helicopter, and I said, either this guy's the dumbest guy in the air, or he's the bravest, and turned out he was the bravest.
Yeah, and followed from the start.
It was great.
Yeah. Any other particular moments you remember from that program?
I got a call from some people who were in the attic in Columbia.
South Carolina.
Yes. They had their own, they were without power. And the only way they could communicate with their own people was to call me in Louisville. And
you were relaying messages, yes.
Yeah.
They were listening in another.
Got a call from a tugboat captain in the Delta of Mississippi. I said, do you have a foghorn? He said, yeah. I said, let's try some. I said, I'm going to go da 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 da, and then you go da 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 with your foghorn. So we had a foghorn concert 750 miles away.
It had to be a first.
That was fun.
Speaking of fun, you had a relationship with a lot of the personalities at WHAS, but I know Gary Burbank and Terry Miners both had you as on their afternoon programs and parried you some. They had some interesting moments with you.
Oh, yeah. Well, Burbank, I would say Burbank and Kevin Ledford were the two most talented people, present company excluded, Jack, that I worked with. They were clever, they were funny, and they're irreverent, especially... And Miners, of course, I want his affection because he was part of a two-man crazy team with another radio
yes.
station. The radio program hired him, and he was at the little station. We were the big one. So, and I was fairly prominent at that time. And I heard him coming down the hall, and I have a pair of vampire fang teeth that I put on, and I had my back to the door, and he didn't know what kind of reception. I was kind of a bookish guy. I wasn't a wild
guy. Oh, you were a revered figure.
Well, yeah, I was, sure. You know, was...
Icon.
So, I wouldn't know about that, thank you, but I turned around and gave him this big grin when my fangs come back. Well, he liked that because he knew that we were accepting him and he didn't need to be afraid of anybody being
that's
standoffish nice. About it.
That's good. That's
he,
good.
I think he still remembers that. I should have bitten him.
I want to talk about a couple of other things. One was the Bingham family. You had a long association with them. Was which of the Binghams were involved when you first came to the radio station? Was Robert Worth Bingham still involved?
Yeah, I used to play tennis with Robert Worth. He didn't. He was involved in the management.
Okay.
He's a very nice guy. He's a good newsman, and I've been an avid tennis player all my life. And I used to play with him. And he had sometimes I'd see him with a little baby under his arm. A nice, very lovely wife named Joan, and I didn't know him well, but we played tennis, and I've met as many nice people playing tennis as I did in broadcasting, and he died tragically with a terrible, unforeseen accident, the clip of
yes.
the, what do you call it?
The surfboard.
Surfboard,
yes.
Accident. I knew him. And Mr. Bingham, he was always approachable and
this Barry Senior or
Senior, yeah. My favorite was Barry Junior. I thought he was the best of the lot. I really liked him. I really liked him.
For what reason, though?
Because he was so. I mean, Hearst had this crazy wax mustache, handlebar mustache, and he drove a car that wasn't as good as mine, and mine wasn't that good. I mean, he had so. When they sold the company, he got $60-80 million or something like that. And you can ask him anything. I once said, well, what do you do with your money, Barry? Oh, he says, people handle it for me. He never took offense at that. I mean,
yeah.
He was really a good guy. And so he's on my program once, on the Mets here phone-in program. And I said, after he had all this money coming, he had sold the company already, had the money, and he was candid about it. When he got sick, he sent out photos. I've got photos of when he had some disease and some heart stuff. But it was open. So I spoke on a program, and he was there. I said, hello, Mets here with Barry Bingham Jr. And the voice on the other end of the line said, hello, Moneybags. And Barry said, Milton, it's for you. Now, you got to love a guy.
That's
like
a great
that.
Yeah. It's a great line.
We used to have. Occasionally, he wasn't a confidant, but we were friends, and I really liked him, and I hated to see him pass out of the scene. Once, we used to eat lunch about once every 2 months, and he said, where do you want to eat this one time? He said, I said, I don't care where. He says, well, let's go to the Jefferson Club. I said, that's all right. I said, but there's only the one thing wrong. He said, what's that? I said, well, I'm not a member. If we go, that means you have to pay. And he says, that's all right, Milton. They tell me I can afford it.
Nice touch.
Just a nice touch.
Nice touch.
And a good newsman and a conscientious guy.
Good.
Yeah.
I want to talk for a minute about you came to WHAS Radio. You saw television come in, and then television became very prominent. Radio was kind of a, not a stepchild, but it was not as prominent as television. But then in the late 60s, early 70s, WHAS Radio began to carve out its own niche, and you were part of that. Do you remember what was going on then, and people like Hugh Barr and what influence they had?
Because
you made that transition very well from all of that.
I did, and some of the people who were prominent prior to that weren't so prominent afterwards. Hugh Barr was the dividing line between the traditionalist good gray citizen of the past and the movement into, we had guys who thought music by Lawrence Welk was classical music. I mean, they thought that was pop. Barr brought a different perspective to it, and he changed a lot of that, especially with music. which was really the golden days of music before piracy and, mm-hmm. and the digital system. I'm not aware of, you know, cosmic changes, but it was very important. Radio was very important.
They had to carve out its own news department and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, they did well, and they were strong about news. They hired Bill Small from Chicago, who was very news-oriented, and they did more investigative reporting than they had. They didn't worry about money so much. Nowadays, you don't find so much investigative reporting because that's a little frill that costs money. But then the 70s were big and very big on television, but radio was still strong. It had, as you said, it carved its own niche out because the car, for instance, I always thought the guy who could invent a system that would measure listenership in car radios could win the Nobel Prize, because there are millions in the car and you have no way of knowing that they're listening. There's an enormous car audience, which you have no control, you have no measure of their listenership. So they did, and drive time was very big, morning and afternoon, because people that were on the radio telling you about the things that mattered most, traffic, weather, and sports. That's why...
immediate impact on their lives.
That's right. That's why, at that time, and even today, the morning program is the most popular radio time, because people are getting ready for school, ready for work, want to know what to wear, want to know what the weather's going to be, how much time do they have to get to the office, do they need a raincoat, is Johnny going to be ready, and so forth. That's very important. And that's why those times are still the most lucrative from a commercial point of view.
Something just occurred to me about your talk program. In the early days, you didn't have car radios. Most people were sitting at home listening to your program.
Exactly.
And calling in, yeah.
Yes, and there wasn't the barrage of TV programs.
Yes.
And it wasn't as much competition. And it was a kind of program that you could listen to part of it. You could take a nap. You could be lying in bed. You didn't have to concentrate on some murder mystery, so forth. And it was a big nighttime audience. It was very gratifying to me, and especially long-distance calls. We never slept off the local people, but they got excited, too. The local
sure.
people said, oh, you got somebody from Greenville, South Carolina. And I heard you last night, you know. And I know that we broke any news stories, but there were some interesting things said. Some are hilarious and so forth.
You maintained that integrity of that for many, many years. That was a real tribute to you.
I try to do a fair job, you know, fair in the fullest sense of the word. I didn't want to be a wimp either, Jack. I didn't want people to walk all over me.
I don't think they ever accused you of that. So. No. Well, let's see. I do want to mention that you'll be modest about this, or maybe you won't. Awards over the years. I know you're a member of the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I was proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago.
Your program probably won some awards too, I suspect, over the years.
American Psych, won a national award for American Psychiatry Association for some programs I did with the psychiatrist,
yes.
Cliff Coon.
Yes.
There was some good stuff that was educational without being dull, which is difficult. I mean, you've got guys with mental problems, you can't make fun of it, and you don't want to be clinical, you're not running a university, so it was good.
That was a unique talent. That was a new talent you had, a unique talent.
And I won some from the SDX, the Journalism Society.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I did one, a funny one, on what you call your wife, the Mrs. with my woman, and I got a few laughs. You know, because everybody has it. I go, the old lady, you know, whatever. I said, you don't do that, but that won an award for a feature thing, which is, I like to do funny stuff.
Yeah.
If I could get a laugh, I like that.
Good job.
I was, and then I was on I was this sinister villain.
Oh, yeah, you were on TRV, weren't you? The kids' television program. Tell me about that.
Well, there again, I wanted, you know, I had to make my own career, you know. Nobody said, come on, we want to put you on there. And I said, well, you need a villain on that program. And they named me Squire McSneer. Now, my wife had a tall girlfriend who gave her a long velvet cape. They say tall because it then enveloped me in a dark shroud. It was really blackjack. It was velvet. And then I got a top hat, and I part of my hat collection, a beat-up old top hat. And I painted on a curlicue mustache and emphasized my sideburns. And I developed a wicked laugh.
Well, a little stronger example of that, please. We've got this.
Yeah, it was better in those days. I had more lung capacity. And I would do terrible things to Randy and Cactus. And once I pulled a gun, it was a cap gun, out of my wristband, out of my waistband. And as I pulled it out, it flew out of my hand, and it flew over the set, out of the program. And this is live television. And I'm there without a hand. I said, I'll shoot you with my finger. I ad-libbed. I mean, you can get away with stuff like that.
Live television.
What gave me what put the end in my character, I was out driving out Taylorsville Road here in Louisville. And I noticed that in a big field, there's a bunch of what looked like reindeer to me. I pulled off to the side, and there are a bunch of miniature reindeer, about 20 of them, in an empty field. And I stood in the middle of the city, and I got this idea. I know what I'll do. Santa Claus is coming. I'll have Snoop McSneer kidnap Santa's St. reindeer. So I got the cameraman out, and I brought some bread out, and I threw the bread over the fence, and they all came clustered around. And the cameraman's taking a picture of the reindeer, and then out of the range of the cameraman, I waved my hands and screamed, and they all went running to the other side. And that was how I kidnapped the reindeer. Well, the boss's kids burst into tears. And that was the end of Squire McSneer.
He was no more.
Well, the guy who would steal Santa's reindeer,
you bet.
Get him off there. That's my short life career, but I enjoyed it.
That's great. That's great. Any other special moments you remember? Any other thing about, when we say WHAS, we think about what it's had such a storied career for a long time of radio and television together. Of course, it's separated today.
Well, it's interesting. When I came, there was a nighttime organ music program with a man named Herbie Cook who played, I mean, they had a pipe organ. Nobody would find pipe organs only in church today. Bach, you know, Mozart. So he would play and Jim Walt would read poetry. And that was interesting. That was bygone. That was really music. That was radio of the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And no commercials, just doing that.
Wow, wow.
When Foster Brooks, that he used to lie on the floor and nobody could see him and read poetry, lying on the floor with the music there. That was interesting, man. A lot of interesting people.
A lot of changes from the time you started to the time you left HAS.
We had a music director. Imagine the music director, and he had a choir. And he was a rambunctious guy, and he was heard to say, when they would sing a gospel song, it says, "Be reverent, don't." There were a lot of characters.
Well, Milton, thank you very much. We can always resume this another time if we think of other thoughts. But you've been very gracious to take the time here and reminisce and give us some laughs and teach us some things we didn't know.
Yeah, you took me back to my youthful years, Jack. Thank you very much.
Our pleasure. Thank you.